what I'm really interested in doing here is essentially also trying to get some feedback of the issue I'm concerned by. Essentially, is I come out much more from the field of development economics and development studies more generally. And what's really been disturbing me a lot in the field of development studies is this whole rise of what's called new institutional economics, or what some people might call neoclassical institutionalism. And what I see in there's a variety of critiques of new institutional economics coming, particularly sort of from the more sort of Marxist perspective. But I see kind of post-Keynesian response to it being lacking, or at least I haven't found one, and perhaps maybe that's where some people might be able to clarify to me if there is one. Because I actually find the sort of the post-Keynesian critique of a new institutional economics to be much more radical than the Marxist critique, at least the way the Marxist or political economy critique has been made so far by people like Hejun Chang or Mushtaq Khan Ben Fine, and so on, you know, a lot of them in the SOAS school, because a lot of this is happening in the field of development economics, because I think it's really taken off there. So I'll try and be brief so then you can give me feedback. But essentially, what we've seen, I think, has been this almost hegemony, particularly in development studies, of this idea of new institutional economics, essentially rooted in this idea that, I suppose it stems from the wave in the 90s onwards, where basically the problem with structural adjustment was not with structural adjustment policies, but was the problem with the institutions supporting structural adjustment. And it's so basically what happens is it becomes a whole emphasis of transaction costs and in transaction cost theory, which is rooted in the idea that what's not bringing about a pure market outcome, of course, is what's obstructing the market. So it could be, for instance, things like instability or lack of stable private property rights or property rights more generally, or it could be the lack of supporting institutional sort of environment that's allowing markets to function efficiently and so on, the enforcement of contracts, et cetera, et cetera. So this type of, but it narrows down the whole question of institutionalism down onto these very specific variables, and this has almost become like an obsession uptake in the literature of then proving whether these to what extent these variables can be used as explaining the causes of developmental failures or the explaining the causes of long-term growth and so on. Why do we call this essentially a neoclassical approach? Basically, it's a neoclassical approach. The way I would frame it as a neoclassical approach is basically by the way it uses as its deductive reference point the idea of a pure market outcome. The fact that if you have this ideal type market, it will result in it's functioning freely, fairly perfectly, fairly competitively, and fairly efficiently. It will result in an outcome that is both equitable according to factor price equalization theory of Samuelson and so on, and that will be efficient, and that will also be Pareto optimal. And therefore, according to sort of a liberal version of development theory, that this will then be the best thing for development because factors will be allocated most efficiently and countries will grow and voila, we become the United States and mass consumption society. So that's kind of the underlying. I think where the new institutionalism really takes off is with the work of Douglas North, for instance, where he, I think, expresses this idea where the development. He's an economic historian who seeks to explain the development of. He draws from the work of Coase, of course, in the 1930s, who I like to always say gave a stupid answer for a stupid question, which was basically, if markets function perfectly, then why do we have firms? And, well, we have firms to lower transaction costs. And therefore, North takes that up and then extends it into the whole analysis of the theory of the firm and transaction costs and so on, and develops this whole theory, which is basically a reiteration of a type of liberal view of basically how the West became rich on the basis of freedom, which is based on securing property rights and so on. I think the thing is that you see variations of obviously the world's not like the pure market outcome. So often people attack, as we know, I don't think I have to say this to a group like here, but people attack neoclassical economics for the deductive pure market outcome, whereas the neoclassical economists, which is basically, most of the mainstream, will respond by saying, obviously stupid, we don't think that the real pure market economy exists like that. So you see various versions that identify more and more market obstructions to achieving that pure market outcome. And the way I would identify those as also neoclassical is basically by the fact that they're trying, and this is where I think the neoclassical institutional theory is very much always focused on what is obstructing the market from achieving that type of pure market outcome. So we find in welfare economics, of course, even Deepak Lal would argue that, right? Deepak Lal would argue that you have second best outcomes in welfare economics as opposed to first best outcomes. He says we've already theorized that. It's not a problem. You go into the new institutional economics, they focus on property rights. They focus on a variety of other institutions that support markets to function perfectly or efficiently or effectively, competitively. This is where I would even categorize Stiglitz as being neoclassical, because Stiglitz's imperfect information paradigm or asymmetric information paradigm is essentially doing the same thing. He's basically saying, he's identifying the obstruction to the market process as something more inherent to market systems, in the sense that the more markets become complex, the more you would likely have asymmetric information, therefore requiring perhaps more permanent forms of regulation. But it's nonetheless using a deductive reference point that if we could solve this, we could move closer to an efficient, equitable, and Pareto optimal outcome. And at that point, one thing that really got me going as well with Stiglitz is an article he wrote in 1986 where he's trying to explain why sharecropping would exist. And he's trying to explain it according to different paradigms. And one paradigm, he says, is the paradigm that explains it according to power relations. And he just basically throws that argument out, saying there's no proper theorization of power, therefore we can ignore that argument. And then goes back to his paradigm of asymmetric information. But essentially, we can see that he's very much rooted in the neoclassical paradigm. I think it's an important point to recognize. So just to give you an example of how this has kind of become almost an accepted hegemony in the mainstream, you have some quotes here from Tim Besley and Simon Burgess. I'm sure you know them. They're sort of the up-and-coming ones at LSE. And they've started this new growth institute. Anyways, they wrote an article in 2003, Having World Poverty, where they write, for instance, quote, a more or less unified approach to assessing the validity of theoretical arguments has set economics apart from other parts of social sciences for more than 50 years. Recent development economics literature has both bolstered traditional themes as well as put a fresh gloss on them. The overarching theme is the centrality of the institutional context in which policy and accumulation decisions are made. So by policy, of course, they refer to trade liberalization and other aspects of the Washington Consensus. And by institutional setting, they refer to the extent to which property rights and contracts are enforced. And they refer largely to, almost exclusively to the literature, for instance, by Acemoglu, Johnson, and Robinson, the colonial origins I forget what the full title is, but where they basically identify expropriation risks and they instrument that with mortality rates of settlers in countries. Or they refer to other people, for instance, using these typical type of measures, enforceability of contracts or security of property rights, instrumentalized through a variety of different variables. Mortality rates has become very popular. Accordingly, Besley and Burgess essentially follow this tradition. Basically, this is the major new insight, that the major progress in development economics over the last 10 years. You find even people like Danny Roderick following this, for instance. I mean, if you read some of Danny Roderick's work, Danny Roderick, Subramaniam, and Rajan, for instance, who they write an article in response to the arguments by Acemoglu, Johnson, and Robinson. But essentially, they're adopting the exact same type of framework, whereas I think, in that sense, Danny Roderick, theoretically, is also rooting him very much in a neoclassical paradigm. So you find... how am I doing for time? 10 minutes? Okay. What's called the political economy responsive to this, largely coming out of Soas people from more of a Marxist perspective. You have Ben Fine, for instance, who attacks Stiglitz all the time. And he's obsessed with Stiglitz, and when I read Ben Fine's stuff, he's basically attacking Stiglitz for using methodological individualism, which I don't actually find a really fundamental critique, because even if we accept fundamental individualism, there are still other problems. You can just sort of I mean, I think, for instance, you know, the capital controversies and all these debates and so on really exposed fundamental problems with the neoclassical system without even having to rely on the argument of methodological individualism. Mushtaq Khan makes, I think, a really interesting contribution where he identifies how processes of capitalist accumulation often involve precisely the instability and the violation of property rights, particularly in the early stages of capitalist development, in the primitive accumulation and so on. So he looks at, for instance, East Asian industrial policy and actually identifies how it's the creation and often the violation or the restructuring of property rights that is behind some very strong industrial state-led industrial policies. Of course, what he doesn't address, and he kind of leaves open and unanswered, is once that process then takes place, and once Korea is like what it is today, do markets then function in a neoclassical manner or not? Right? We know that you often find a certain dualism, I find, in the literature, that yes, the beginning processes of capital's accumulation do require violations and so on, but then what happens once we've established this? I think this is really clearly expressed in the work of He-jun Chang as well, because He-jun Chang has critiqued a lot of the new institutionalist literature. But the argument he essentially makes is that he says markets are instituted, right? So we see a variety of different processes that surround markets and that establish, as he says, I have a quote here, he argues that even free markets are political constructs of rights, obligations, structures, and are regulated in the sense that state involvement sets the playing field, who plays, the terms of play, etc. No market in the end is free, as all markets have some state regulation on who can participate in which markets and on what terms. It is only because some state regulations and the rights and obligations that they support or even create can be so totally accepted by some markets, totally accepted that some markets appear to have no intervention at all and are therefore considered free. Okay, that's fine. What I see He-jun Chang essentially talking about, I think it's a very valid point. He claims that this is basically a Polanyian position, Karl Polanyi's type of argument. I think Polanyi was making a somewhat different argument that but nonetheless, it's, you know, you see sort of like the same way we say today bailing out the banks is Keynesian, somehow this argument becomes Polanyian. I don't actually think a lot of new institutional economic authors like Douglas North would disagree with him. They would actually probably agree with him quite a bit. Because what he's essentially talking about is how markets are instituted, but he's not actually talking about the markets themselves stay as a sort of black box. So what's actually then happening once you institute the markets? Do they then move into equilibrium, or do they not move into equilibrium, for instance? And I mean, I think it's precisely here where I don't think that a lot of this Marxist literature is really addressing the issue, and where I think I feel that a post-Keynesian approach to institutionalism would be really is needed, essentially. And so that's what I'm trying to develop in my paper. So it's not so much of a detailed reading of Keynes as much as just more of an inspiration of my understanding of Keynes and the post-Keynesian arguments, which is essentially, and when I refer to the post-Keynesian in that sense, it's looking very much at, Keynes's position that even in a pure market situation, a relatively pure market situation, you can have you can have a situation where markets do not clear. For a variety of different reasons. Now, here, what we see then is the important division between sort of the post-Keynesian and the neo-Keynesian / neoclassical synthesis, where Keynes's whole, you know, it depends how you read Keynes, in the sense, one reading of Keynes is that whole outcome that Keynes was describing was due to sticky wages and sticky prices, and therefore it's again brings it back into a neoclassical form of institutionalism, which is essentially trying to explain the sticky wages is another reason for obstructions to the market process. Whereas, of course, then you have the post-Keynesian reading of Keynes, which is that actually, okay, Keynes did make a slip in a few points and describe his argument that way, perhaps for pedantic reasons or whatever, for demonstration of, and you know, he has all these inconsistencies. But he also clearly stated that you could also explain sort of a lack of market clearance in a context of flexible wages, for instance, right? And I think we all agree with that because we're here in a post-Keynesian study group. And so, it's really that, I think that's really the key point, is that, he made that argument theoretically, but of course, at the aggregate level, we know the whole argument that if you have you know, for, I think this is really important, a key issue for Keynes that he was really trying to battle with in the 30s, according to my understanding, was this whole argument that you could increase employment by allowing wages to fall, right? Whereas actually it was quite the opposite, that because, you know, aggregate demand falls and then so on. But more fundamentally, I think the in terms of an how to bring this into an institutionalist understanding, it more than just this question of whether wages are sticky or not and so on, I think it refers to, how to say it. I'll try and wrap this up quickly in 3 minutes, because this is the essence of what I'm trying to get at. And it's essentially what the way I see is Keynes, particularly dealing with the aggregate, essentially what he's dealing with a lot of is what I would call pseudo-markets. And I think actually what I mean by pseudo-markets is we use the market by way of an analogy, but you know, the pure market is referring to a very specific institutional context and so on, where you have, you know, we know that whole thing. Whereas actually when we go up into more aggregate, 5 minutes, okay, when we go up to more aggregate types of mediations of supply and demand, what we would call mediations of supply and demand, particularly, for instance, the two key ones being, for Keynes, being labor markets and the, labor markets and the mediation between savings and investment, we don't actually have any clearly identifiable market in that type of situation. We might have a variety of complex interlinking markets, and we might also have a wide variety of non-market types of institutions guiding this mediation between supply and demand, but we don't have anything that can be accurately described as a market. And I find often, even in the left, we've fallen into a type of fetishism of the market analogy. That we talk about the market society, but I always like to say to my students, where's the market? How often do we actually engage with the market in our daily economic activities? And there's pure markets on the two extremes of financial instruments and primary commodities, but in between that, there's a huge space of economic activity that does involve a mediation of supply and demand, but not necessarily through market types of processes. And in particular, what I see with although Keynes doesn't express his arguments according to an institutionalist language, what I see in a lot of Keynes is this basically what Ha-Jun Chang or even Douglas North are trying to get at is basically the institutional setting that sets the market and the terms of the market. But within that institutional setting, you then create a setting whereby essentially both the buyers and sellers are operating according to similar sets of incentives within the market. And that's the way you can actually have a bargaining type of market process going on, is because they're responding to similar sets of incentives, which are essentially price and quantity decisions and so on, and they come together in this marketplace and have these... Whereas essentially what I see with Keynes, is when I read Keynes, particularly at the aggregate level in these pseudo-markets, is actually what you find is the economic actors, particularly the suppliers and the demanders, to use that to that type of those terms, are responding to very different sets of institutional incentives. And so there's nothing to, and those sets of incentives are not necessarily coordinated in any way, and there's nothing to guarantee a coordination between those sets of incentives. So there's nothing actually to guarantee within that setting that there would be any form of market clearance except by way of some form of public or social regulation. And so I'll leave it there because I've run out of time. That's the essence of the post-Keynesian institutionalism that I'm trying to develop. And the relevance of that, of course, for arguments of sustainability would be this whole assumption, for instance, the discussion today with Terry Barker and the whole idea that markets can function efficiently and so on. I think, again, it's this type of market fetishism that I think actually even pervades a lot of the left to a certain degree, in the sense that we can't expect the markets to produce efficient, equitable, or dispersion across actors and so on without some form of regulation of those markets. And there's no guarantee, essentially, for a type of market-clearing outcome without that regulation. And to a certain degree, it's kind of trying to break open this type of market fetishism that we have, I think, pervading both the left and the right. And I think Keynes had something there, and I'd love your feedback on this, because I'm sure you know much more about
the specifics of Keynes than I do, and also the literature. So, anyways, thank you.